Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and we're going to read the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 6th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. The headline is Pleasant and Dry Before Wetter Weather Settles in Later Thursday. Wednesday should be a great one, but things turn a little less pleasant to wrap up the work week. Another winner of a day, weather-wise. Temperatures this morning are cool, but not overwhelmingly cold, with most areas starting in the upper 20s to low 30s. Winds are relatively light, but enough air movement is out there to keep wind chills in the low to mid-20s. The biggest difference today will be the lack of low cloud cover, which kept a good portion of the area gray yesterday. Instead, a good amount of sunshine should be present through the morning, allowing temperatures to steadily climb into the mid-50s by this afternoon. Clouds may increase a bit as the day goes on, with at least partly cloudy skies lasting into tonight. Another patch of clearing appears on track for early Thursday, before clouds increase once again. This is the first sign of a storm system that's on its way, which will be our main weather driver to end the work and school week. Rain chances increase as soon as Thursday afternoon in the south, spreading slowly northward through Thursday evening. The activity should be at its most widespread on Thursday night into Friday morning, with precipitation gradually ending later on Friday. Thunderstorm activity looks unlikely during this time, so count on just plain showers. Due to the track of the low-pressure center with this storm system, eastern Iowa will be in a favorable spot for a prolonged period of rainfall chances. The most favored parts of the area will be the farther south you go, though everyone should see at least some rain out of this. Totals have a good chance to exceed half an inch in most places, with amounts of an inch or more are possible. This would be great for ongoing drought conditions. Any lingering showers move on by Friday night, leaving behind windy and cooler conditions to start off the weekend. Mid to upper 40s are the best we can manage for highs on Saturday, but we'll see a little bit of improvement temperature-wise on Sunday. Highs should return to the 50s for many of us by then. Sunshine will be widespread on both days, so it will still be a decent weekend overall. The weather pattern becomes more favorable for even warmer air to flow into the region by early and middle portions of next week. As a result, high temperatures will surge into the 60s yet again, with mid to upper 60s possible by next Tuesday or Wednesday. Nighttime lows will start in the 20s on Monday, warming toward the 40s by Wednesday and Thursday. And that's the evening lows. A small storm system helps us to get those warmest temperatures in the middle of next week and provide a chance for a few showers on Wednesday, a week from now. Turning to the front page now, the headline is Biden Easily Wins Caucus. Challengers don't meet minimum threshold to be awarded delegates. Story filed by Caleb McCullough and begins with a photograph of election consultants as they tally the presidential preference cards at the headquarters of the Iowa Democratic Party in Des Moines on Tuesday. And we see computer screens and printers and TV cameras and a couple of consultants. Dateline is Des Moines. President Joe Biden easily won the Iowa Democratic mail-in caucus on Tuesday, winning a vote of confidence from the state's Democrats in the first contest since the state was booted from the first spot in the party's nominating calendar. As the last votes were being tabulated at the party headquarters Tuesday morning, Iowa Democratic Party Chair Rita Hart said this year's all-mail contest was the result of years of work by the state's party. Quote, "I've been the chair here at the Iowa Democratic Party for a little over a year now, but this process started before I did," she said. "And so this is the final culmination of seeing who the Democrats in Iowa are choosing to be their nominee for president," unquote. Biden won 91% of the votes, according to unofficial results, announced by the party Tuesday night. Marianne Williamson, a self-help author, received 2%, while U.S. Representative Dean Phillips of Minnesota received 3%. 4% cast their votes as uncommitted. With neither long-shot challenger receiving the minimum threshold of 15% of the votes, Biden will be awarded all of the state's 46 delegates to the Democratic National Convention. In total, 12,193 Iowa Democrats returned presidential preference cards in Iowa Democrats' first run at the new process as of Tuesday afternoon. The results from Iowa, one of 16 states and territories to hold a Democratic contest on Super Tuesday, came without the frenzy and media attention that usually accompanies the Iowa caucuses. Instead of voters scrambling into corners in crowded school gyms and complicated caucus math, the vote counting took place in a small room in a nondescript Des Moines office building. The party contracted with a team led by Amber McReynolds, the founding CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, to oversee the voting and tabulation process. The state party was forced to reinvent its nominating process after the Democratic National Committee removed Iowa from its decades-old position at the front of the presidential primary calendar. After a botched results process in the 2020 Iowa Democratic caucuses, the Democratic National Committee moved to reorder the nominating calendar in an effort to elevate the voices of people of color and encourage primaries over caucuses. The National Party promoted South Carolina to the top spot, awarding the state that gave a kickstart to Biden's 2020 campaign. While Iowa Democrats held party organizing caucuses in January, the same day as the Republicans' first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses, the new calendar meant they could not tally votes until after the other early states had voted. Democrats have long had concerns about the accessibility of the Iowa caucuses, which requires voters to go to a caucus site for hours on a winter evening. Critics say the caucuses are inaccessible for people who work nights, have disabilities, or leave the state in the winter. In contrast to those in-person caucuses, Hart said this year's contest is the most accessible in the party's history. All registered Democrats in the state had the option to request a presidential preference card. Quote, "This is the first time that in Iowa, when you work third shift, or when you have small children and you don't have child care in the evenings, you still got to have your voice heard," Hart said. Quote, "People still participated in this process," unquote. The Iowa Democratic Party received 19,609 caucus card requests, and cards postmarked by Tuesday can be counted if they arrive to the party's headquarters by Friday. The party will certify the official results tally on March 16th, Hart said. The number of returned caucus cards so far falls short of the number of people who participated in the party's 2012 caucus, the last time an incumbent Democrat was on the presidential ballot. And it is just a fraction of the more than 200,000 who participated in the competitive 2008 caucuses, which catapulted former President Barack Obama's campaign. Around 110,000 Republicans participated in the party's caucus this year, where there was a competitive presidential contest. In a statement on Tuesday, Republican Party of Iowa Chair Jeff Kaufman said Iowa's Democrats' pivot to the mail-in system was an attempt to appease national party leaders over the interests of Iowans. Quote, "The Iowa GOP caucus held in January was a lively, grassroots-driven, transparent model of democracy," Kaufman said. "Preserving Iowa's first-in-the-nation status ensures that literally everyone can be president. Now, more than ever, it's important that those who want to run our country are not just crowned by the establishment, but rather that the grassroots of each party decides who their nominee should be, unquote. Working to rebuild. The caucuses have long served as a tool for party organizing, as candidates have flooded the state with money and media attention during competitive years, driving voter registration and turnout at the caucuses. But without that draw, Iowa's Democrats face an organizing challenge, compounding their waning competitiveness in state elections. Hart said the party is examining how it can encourage voters under the new process to turn out for the in-person caucuses and engage them to show up on Election Day. Iowa Democrats have, quote, a long ways to go, Hart said. We've talked in the past about how we're reimagining these in-person caucuses now, and I think that is exactly the way to look at it, she said. It's different. It's a new process. So we've got to figure out how to create more interest around that, how to get better participation at the in-person caucuses, just like we're looking at the way to tweak the mail-in process, unquote. Iowa House votes to ban ballot drop boxes and shorten return deadline. Tom Barton of the Gazette Lee Des Moines Bureau wrote this article, and it begins with a photograph of a voter arriving at a local polling place, and we're looking from the inside through a glass door to the outside, and there's a sticker that says voting place, and on the other side of the glass it says vote here, and we see a woman walking up to the door. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa House Republicans passed legislation Tuesday that would again constrain the time period and options for early voting in Iowa elections. The House voted 62-35 to pass House File 2610 with all Republicans in support and all Democrats opposed. The bill now heads to the Iowa Senate, which has advanced a companion bill out of committee. The bill makes changes to state elections law that would limit challenges to federal candidates' placement on the ballot, create an earlier deadline for absentee ballots to be received by local elections officials, ban absentee ballot drop boxes, and ban ranked choice voting, among other changes. Democrats vehemently opposed the bill, arguing it would make it harder for certain Iowans to cast a ballot. Republicans said the bill aims to maintain the highest level of election integrity in Iowa. Quote, voter suppression from these bills is a myth, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton, lead sponsor of the bill. He said several states, including Colorado, New York, Massachusetts, Hawaii, Maryland, and Connecticut, have more restrictive laws. Quote, this bill expands voting rights by 5%. It gives Iowans more time to vote, Kaufman said during the debate. It ensures that our vote remains the most secure in the country. And, thank goodness, it prevents activists from deciding who is on the ballot. It prevents activists from subverting the will of the people, unquote. Representatives from county auditors, the League of Women Voters, and the AARP Iowa opposed the bill, saying it would make it more difficult for older Iowans and people with disabilities to return their ballots. They also said it has become a constant struggle to educate Iowans about new voting rules and deadlines. Lawmakers in recent years have shortened Iowa's early voting period and stripped auditors of much of their discretion in running elections in their counties, including restricting their ability to establish satellite in-person early voting sites and mail out absentee ballot request forms. Representative Adam Zabner, a Democrat from Iowa City, and other Democrats said instances of voter fraud in Iowa are exceedingly rare to necessitate such changes to the state's election laws. The wife of a Northwest Iowa county supervisor was convicted by a federal jury in November of 52 counts of voter fraud in a scheme to stuff the ballot box in her husband's unsuccessful race for a Republican nomination to run for Congress in 2020. Quote, there has not been one argument provided for how this bill increases so-called election integrity, Zabner said. there has not been one argument provided for widespread voter fraud anywhere in the history of these changes that have made voting more restrictive. All we do know is it makes it harder for Iowans to vote, unquote. Under the bill, absentee ballots would have to be received by the county auditor by the close of business day on the day before Election Day to be counted, one day earlier than the current law. Now, ballots received by the time polls close on Election Day are eligible to be counted. Auditors would be able to begin mailing out absentee ballots 2 days earlier to compensate for the earlier deadline. That would give Iowa voters an additional day to mail back absentee ballots. In-person early voting still would begin 20 days in advance of an election. The bill also would require absentee voters to include their voter identification number when returning their ballots. Current law requires voters to provide those numbers only when they submit a written request for a ballot. The measure would set new requirements for absentee ballot envelopes, which the Iowa State Association of County Auditors says would require counties to incur significant costs by buying new envelopes. A fiscal note by the nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency estimates the cost increase statewide for new envelope printing at $800,000 for presidential election years and $286,000 for midterm election years. Kaufman said absentee ballot drop boxes no longer are needed with the end of the COVID-19 public health emergency. COVID-19 severely disrupted elections in 2020. State voting systems were overwhelmed by long lines and an influx of absentee ballot requests, leading to the use of drop boxes. Kaufman said Iowa voters still could deposit ballots in blue drop boxes that are in every city in every county in the state of Iowa, referring to the U.S. Postal Service mailboxes. He also asserted having documentable proof that ballot drop boxes were installed in an alley, a Hy-Vee, and outside a courthouse. Quote, "That is not secure," Kaufman said. Voting rights activists and county election officials, however, note mail delivery may be delayed and take days, whereas a drop box lets voters know for certain their absentee ballots have been received, insulating Trump from challenges. The bill also would prohibit Iowa-based ballot challenges, like the one in Colorado and Illinois, that sought to remove former President Donald Trump from the ballot over claims he incited an insurrection. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled this week in a unanimous decision that Trump could remain on the ballot. Candidates for federal offices could be challenged only in U.S. Constitution requirements on age, residency, citizenship, and whether their nominating papers met all legal requirements. Iowans could still challenge Trump's eligibility in court. The bill also would remove a rule that federal candidates must sign a statement indicating they are aware they are disqualified from holding office if they have been convicted of a felony. Trump faces 91 felony charges in 4 criminal cases. Kaufman, who served as a senior advisor to Trump's 2024 Iowa caucus campaign, said legal activists should not be deciding who is eligible to be on the ballot. Democrats say bill will make it harder to vote. Iowa City's Zabner said such new restrictions on absentee voting could prevent thousands of Iowans from having their ballots counted. He said 13,883 Iowans during the 2022 general election returned their ballots via an absentee ballot drop box that are secured and monitored around the clock, and 3,000 Iowans returned absentee ballots on Election Day. About 150 ballots that would have been valid under previous Iowa law were not counted due to new restrictions on absentee voting enacted in 2021, he said. Representative Amy Nielsen, Democrat from North Liberty, proposed an amendment to make voting easier and more accessible, including automatic voter registration, expanding early voting to 45 days, allowing county auditors to begin counting absentee ballots earlier, making it harder to remove people from voter rolls, expanding use of ballot drop boxes, and allowing counties discretion to establish satellite voting locations. The amendment was defeated by Republicans on a party-line vote. Quote, "I have yet to hear any kind of argument or example of how drop boxes are not providing integrity in our elections," said Representative Heather Mattson, a Democrat from Ankeny. Quote, "To me, that's a false argument. I think it's a terrible idea, in my opinion. What we should be doing is making voting easier, not harder. What we should be thinking about is civic engagement and ways in which we want people to participate in this country," unquote. Administration wants to cap credit card late fees. Business lobby says it will sue to block the federal agency's rule. The story comes to us from the Associated Press. Dateline Washington. The Biden administration announced a rule Tuesday to cap all credit card late fees, the latest effort in the White House push to end what it calls junk fees, and a move that regulators say will save Americans up to $10 billion a year. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's new regulations will set a ceiling of $8 for most credit card late fees, or require banks to show why they should charge more than $8 for such a fee. The proposal would bring the average credit card late fee down from $32. The Bureau estimates banks brought in about $14 billion in credit card late fees a year. President Joe Biden also said he will form a new strike force to crack down on illegal and unfair pricing on things like groceries, prescription drugs, health care, housing, and financial services. Rob Nichols, the CEO of the American Bankers Association, said the CFPB relied on flawed assumptions and a mischaracterization of the important role of late fees pay in promoting responsible consumer behavior, unquote. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce said it will file a lawsuit to try to prevent the federal agency from capping late fees at $8. Hawkeye Community College receives favorable rating from auditor. Dateline Waterloo. The story begins with a photograph of the front face of the Hawkeye Community College, and it shows the large curved glass front of the building. Hawkeye Community College received a favorable rating from Bergen KDV of Minneapolis in its fiscal year 2023 audit. Ryan Eaglestad recently presented the audit to the Board of Trustees for the year that ended June 30th and gave the college kudos for staying so close to its budget. Hawkeye had $70.63 million in revenues and $70.41 million in expenditures. Tuition and fees dropped $1.78 million. Federal appropriations, including Pell Grants, decreased $4.03 million as pandemic relief ended in 2022. Quote, "Given the continued enrollment declines that the higher education industry faces, it is certainly a good result to be in this break-even position for the year," Eaglestad told the board. Hawkeye and other educational entities are required to be audited by a third party each year to ensure they fairly state their financial position. Auditors did not identify any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses over financial reporting or major programs where there were no instances of noncompliance. John Deere to build massive new tractor in Waterloo starting in mid-2024. The largest and highest horsepower tractor John Deere has ever made is expected to roll off the assembly lines in Waterloo in mid-2024. Company officials announced today its brand new 9RX tractor, a flexible swivel joint articulated tractor with four huge treads or tracks, will be manufactured in Waterloo. The tractor can be fitted with 830, 770, or 710 horsepower engines, depending on consumer needs. Quote, it will be the most productive, highest horsepower, smartest tractor that we've ever produced, said Brett Scholwalter, large tractor and tillage manager at Deere in Waterloo. And we can carry that flag across the industry as well. There's no other tractor out there that will be even close to the productivity that this tractor will be able to offer, unquote. The announcement was made today at the 2024 Commodity Classic Trade Show in Houston and was provided to the Courier. Quote, it's an amazing tractor, said Becky Gwynn, vice president and factory manager of Deere's Waterloo operations. While local officials declined to say whether the new tractor line would create any additional jobs going forward, they noted preparations have been in the works for some time. Some 1,200 positions at the 5,500-employee Waterloo operations have been filled in a series of hiring failures over the past 3 to 4 years. Gwynn noted Deere has invested some $500 million in its Waterloo operations over that same period. A major portion of the East Donald Street Tractor Cab Assembly Operations Plant, known to many longtime residents as the Tractor Works or the Northeast Site, is currently under renovation. The new tractors, in a conventional Midwestern farm setting, would primarily be used for tillage, an increasingly time-sensitive operation that has to be done at opportune windows in between weather swings. Quote, your windows are unpredictable, and there isn't a lot of time to do tillage, Scholwalter said. Being able to be productive in the spring and in the fall are what we're aiming to do with this machine. The horsepower is unprecedented, Gwynn and Scholwalter said. Quote, these tractors in the low 700s today in horsepower, Scholwalter said. This is far and away industry-leading from a horsepower and productivity standpoint. Quote, this is ground-up, brand-new, redesigned machine that the top model will be at 830 horsepower. There are two models below, 770 and 710 as well, he said. An existing Trax model with two tracks on either side of the machine is very popular, Scholwalter said. These new articulated models with four tracks are an extension of that. Quote, the Trax system allows me to get the power to the ground with more efficiency and provides greater traction to be able to pull implements in lots of different conditions, he said. The tractor can power through tough traction areas, displacing the weight of the machine and minimizing compaction of the soil that would make the earth harder to till. The new tractor line was conceived and is being built entirely in Waterloo Cedar Falls at the various plants making up Deere's massive manufacturing complex. It includes a new 18-liter engine manufactured at the Deere Engine Works on West Ridgeway Avenue. Quote, when you talk about artificial intelligence or virtual tools or analytics, we really pushed the envelope so much further on this program than we ever have in the past, Gwynn said. That gives us some really good confidence on our ability to have the quality controls and manufacturing capability, the overall durability and performance that our customers expect, unquote. The new product line is being introduced in addition to Deere's Waterloo-made and still relatively new 8R series tractors, rolled out in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020, and the continued rollout of the remotely guided, driverless, autonomous tractor announced in 2022. And now, listeners, we just want to take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 6th, on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's read from the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the New York Times, titled, What Would Nancy Reagan Do? This is by Gal Hodges Burt. Ms. Burt was a social secretary to President Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan from 1983 to 1985. I write this as a great admirer of First Lady Jill Biden. As the presidential election grows nearer, I cannot help but think that she must be more and more conflicted. The choice she faces, promoting her husband's political ambitions or protecting his legacy, can no longer be avoided. Having worked closely with Nancy Reagan during her husband's first term, and seeing how she weighed choices like this one, I found myself wondering if Mrs. Reagan were in Dr. Biden's position, what advice would she have given to Ronald Reagan? Nancy was both a sounding board and guardian of her husband's interests and those of the country. In the end, I believe Nancy Reagan would have counseled Ronald Reagan to protect his legacy of stabilizing the economy, confronting the Soviet Union, and restoring American self-confidence over seeking a second term, especially if he had been at such risk of losing re-election. Mr. Reagan and Mr. Biden's legacies hang in the balance because of issues related to age. Of course, those issues and circumstances were different. Toward the end of Mr. Reagan's presidency, age started to have an impact on his performance. He did not announce his diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease until 1994, some 6 years later. Mrs. Reagan's protective instincts kicked in, reducing his schedule and prioritizing his agenda. Earlier, Mr. Reagan had used his age against his presidential rival, Walter Mondale, to considerable political advantage. Quote, "I am not going to exploit, for political purposes, my opponent's youth and inexperience," he said. Mr. Biden's age has clearly become a burden for his re-election prospects. According to a recent ABC News Ipsos poll, 73% of Democrats believe that Mr. Biden is too old to serve another term as president. In each case, the presidents enjoyed a steadfast backing that went beyond the fierce loyalty for which most first ladies are known. Mrs. Reagan's backing extended even to urging her husband to stand up to his powerful ideological advisors. I don't know whether Dr. Biden does the same, but it is clear that she is highly capable and politically savvy, and that her husband depends on her. I have always felt that the relationship between Ronald and Nancy Reagan, which I had the honor to observe at close quarters, created a whole that was much larger than the sum of its parts. Together, they were much better, more forceful and effective than their individual selves. This is not surprising, as the 80-year-plus Harvard study of adult development has demonstrated. We are far better off in reliable long-term partnerships than going it alone. The Reagans were married for 52 years. The Bidens have been married for 46 years. This kind of bond is irreplaceable. It gives each partner the unique legitimacy of being a trusted advisor, an honest broker, and truth teller. I have often wondered if Martin Ginsburg, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband of 56 years, had been alive in the last 5 years of her life, whether things might have worked out differently for her legacy and for the future of the Supreme Court. Now, after Justice Ginsburg's storied and record-breaking career, there will always be an asterisk or a but next to her name. When Mrs. Reagan identified a problem for her husband, she immediately stepped in. When she saw that he was being overscheduled, she was the one to first call his chief of staff, even though no one enjoyed those calls. When she saw her husband fumbling his words, she was always there to help with a word in his ear. As Mr. Reagan came to the end of his presidency, she was focused like a laser beam on his legacy. Among his advisors, she was the strongest advocate for the breakthrough with the Soviet Secretary General Mikhail Gorbachev, which eventually produced the downfall of the Soviet Union. Her role even included whispering in the foreign minister Andrei Gromyko's ear. Certainly, that development remains one of the central pillars of Mr. Reagan's legacy. Mr. Biden, who campaigned in 2020 on being a transitional president, has indeed accomplished much. He ended a forever war, although it was not a pretty ending. He has substantially lowered unemployment, staved off a recession, steered the country through two wars that have the possibility of becoming much broader conflicts, and, like Mr. Reagan, succeeded in reaching across the aisle to achieve bipartisan legislation. But perhaps most importantly, he steadied the country after January 6, 2021, and steadied our allies in the process. These are all accomplishments that will forever be to his credit. How tragic would it be if they were overshadowed by a loss to Donald Trump, who might then set about dismantling, in addition to the achievements of Mr. Trump's first term, American democracy, the very thing Mr. Biden has devoted his presidency to protecting. For sure, it's hard when you feel you are accomplishing so much to be faced with these existential choices. But alas, age does not let any of us out of its clutches. When mortality finally caught up with Justice Ginsburg, she felt that she could influence the future by dictating a statement to her granddaughter about her wishes. We know how that worked out. I believe Nancy Pelosi took note of exactly that and drew the correct conclusion when she stepped down as House Speaker in 2022. What people of a certain age and set of accomplishments should reflect on is the mark that they have left, the people that they have mentored, and the stewardship they have provided to the next generation. As Ms. Pelosi showed, passing the baton to the next generation is vital work that also brings a sense of closure to one's career and a sense of accomplishment and lasting satisfaction. Of course, I do not know what conversations are going on in private at the White House between the First Lady and the President, but I do believe that if Mrs. Reagan were in Dr. Biden's shoes, she would be totally focused on securing the president's legacy, which would certainly be destroyed should Donald Trump become president again. I hope Dr. Biden is having that conversation with Mr. Biden. I certainly know Nancy Reagan would be. Next, we have an editorial written by Laurel Hansen, and it's titled, "I Investigated Child Abuse in Iowa for Decades. Kim Reynolds is Wrong About the Threats." The author here, Laura Hansen, retired after more than three decades as a social worker with the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services Child Protective Assessments Unit in Polk County. Here's the text. Governor Kim Reynolds, Republican legislators, and their anti-LGBTQ plus supporters are protecting pedophiles and placing children at risk of sexual abuse by advocating and advancing their predator protection agenda. I was a child abuse investigator for the state of Iowa, primarily in Polk County, for 34 years. In over three decades of investigations conducted jointly with area law enforcement agencies, I never investigated a child sex abuse case perpetrated by a drag queen. Never, in over three decades, did I ever hear a child report during a forensic interview at the Regional Child Protection Center that he or she was assaulted in a bathroom by a drag queen or trans stranger. Never did I even read such an account when reviewing thousands of case histories over decades. Although I heard many children's accounts of being groomed by a sexual predator, not one child mentioned being groomed by a school library book. Why? Because the overwhelming majority of child sexual abuse is perpetrated by male members of the child's family, fathers, stepfathers, mothers, paramours, uncles, grandfathers, siblings, cousins, or the family's inner circle, pastors, youth leaders, coaches, babysitters, and neighbors. I investigated hundreds of such cases. The vast majority of child sexual abuse, like most violent crime assaults, is perpetrated by those who are close to the child and family and have easy access. These are the predators who are grooming children, not the author of a memoir or a book with an LGBTQ+ character. Predators threaten children not to report sexual abuse. They tell them they will not be believed if they do. Are Republicans trying to make it less likely for a child reporting sexual abuse to be believed by legislating these lies? Since Reynolds and legislators, book ban advocates, and Don't Say Gay propagandists initiated their assault on the LGBTQ+ community, I've taken note of news stories further documenting that most convicted child sex perpetrators are purportedly heterosexual, often married men. Often they are youth pastors, family members, neighbors, healthcare professionals. These facts are available to Reynolds and the legislators through crime, court, and Child Protective Service records. So why do they not cite this information? Why are they protecting sexual predators and pedophiles instead of Iowa children? Iowans need to have factual information to protect children from predators. Children need to know how to identify their body parts with correct names, be it an elbow, a penis, or a vagina. They must be educated to identify and report unwanted touch. It is imperative that they are not misled by politicians to fear drag queens instead of the statistically more predatory members of our society, often in their own families. This is not to suggest that women or trans persons are not or cannot be predators. Those who truly oppose child sexual victimization must prove it by abandoning the propaganda and demanding dissemination of factual information and education. If this information upsets you, and it should, contact Governor Reynolds and her fellow propagandists and demand that they stop protecting pedophiles through their LGBTQ+ vilifying campaign. From the New York Times, David French writes, "The Supreme Court just erased part of the Constitution." And the editorial begins with a black and white photograph of the Supreme Court, and the flag is flying at half staff. As of Monday, March 4, 2024, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution is essentially a dead letter, at least as it applies to candidates for federal office. Under the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling that reversed the Colorado Supreme Court's decision striking Donald Trump from the state's primary ballot, even insurrectionists who violated their previous oath of office can hold federal office unless and until Congress passes specific legislation to enforce Section 3. In the aftermath of the oral argument last month, legal observers knew with near certainty that the Supreme Court was unlikely to apply Section 3 to Trump. None of the justices seemed willing to uphold the Colorado court's ruling, and only Justice Sonia Sotomayor gave any meaningful indication that she might dissent. The only real question remaining was the reasoning for the court's decision. Would the ruling be broad or narrow? A narrow ruling for Trump might have held, for example, that Colorado didn't provide him with enough due process when it determined that Section 3 applied. Or the court could have held that Trump, as president, was not an officer of the United States within the meaning of the section. Such a ruling would have kept Trump on the ballot, but it would have also kept Section 3 viable to block insurrectionists from the House or Senate and from all other federal offices. A somewhat broader ruling might have held that Trump did not engage in insurrection or rebellion or provide aid and comfort to the enemies of the Constitution. Such a ruling would have sharply limited Section 3 to apply almost exclusively to Civil War-style conflicts, an outcome at odds with the text and original public meaning of the section. It's worth noting that, by not taking this path, the court did not exonerate Trump from participating in an insurrection. But instead of any of these options, the court went with arguably the broadest reasoning available, that Section 3 isn't self-executing, and thus has no force or effect in the absence of congressional action. This argument is rooted in Section 5 of the amendment, which states that Congress shall have the power to enforce, by appropriate legislation, the provisions of this article, unquote. But Section 5, on its face, does not give Congress exclusive power to enforce the amendment. As Justices Elena Kagan, Sotomayor, and Ketanji Brown Jackson pointed out in their own separate concurring opinion, quote, all the Reconstruction amendments, including the due process and equal protection guarantees and prohibition of slavery, are self-executing, meaning that they do not depend on legislation, unquote. While Congress may pass legislation to help enforce the 14th Amendment, it is not required to do so, and the 14th Amendment still binds federal, state, and local governments, even if Congress refuses to act. But now Section 3 is different from other sections of the amendment. It requires federal legislation to enforce its terms, at least as applied to candidates for federal office. Through inaction alone, Congress can effectively erase part of the 14th Amendment. It's extremely difficult to square this ruling with the text of Section 3. The language is clearly mandatory. The first words are, quote, no person shall be, unquote, a member of Congress or a state or a federal officer if that person has engaged in insurrection or rebellion or provided aid or comfort to the enemies of the Constitution. The section then says, quote, but Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability, unquote. In other words, the Constitution imposes the disability, and only a supermajority of Congress can remove it. But under the Supreme Court's reasoning, the meaning is inverted. The Constitution merely allows Congress to impose the disability. And if Congress chooses not to enact legislation enforcing the section, then the disability does not exist. The Supreme Court has effectively replaced a very high bar for allowing insurrectionists into federal office, a supermajority vote by Congress, with the lowest bar imaginable, congressional inaction. As Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson point out, this approach is also inconsistent with the constitutional approach to other qualifications for the presidency. We can bar individuals from holding office who are under age limit or who don't meet the relevant citizenship requirement without congressional enforcement legislation. We can enforce the two-term presidential term limit without congressional enforcement legislation. Section 3 now stands apart, not only from the rest of the 14th Amendment, but also from the other constitutional requirements for the presidency. In one important respect, the court's ruling on Monday is worse and more consequential than the Senate's decision to acquit Trump after his January 6th impeachment trial in 2021. Impeachment is entirely a political process, and the actions of one Senate have no bearing on the actions of future Senates. But a Supreme Court ruling has immense precedential power. The court's decision is now the law. It would be clearly preferable if Congress were to pass enforcement legislation that established explicit procedures for resolving disputes under Section 3, including setting the burden of proof and creating timetables and deadlines for filing challenges and hearing appeals. Establishing a uniform process is better than living with a patchwork of state proceedings. But the fact that Congress has not acted should not effectively erase the words from the constitutional page. Chaotic enforcement of the Constitution may be suboptimal, but it's far better than not enforcing the Constitution at all. Next, from the New York Times, we have an opinion written by Paul Krugman titled, Trump is Running on Dystopian Fantasies. President Biden recently went to New York to appear on Late Night with Seth Meyers. On the show, he was the same guy whom those of us who've spoken with him have seen. Not a spring chicken, obviously, but lucid, well-informed, and moderately funny. The contrast couldn't be greater with Donald Trump, whose ranting has become increasingly incoherent after mixing up Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi a few weeks back. He has now once again appeared to confuse Biden with Barack Obama. But not to worry. Trump recently assured an audience, quote, "There's no cognitive problem. If there were, I'd know about it," unquote. Oh, Republicans aren't going to acknowledge either Biden's lucidity or Trump's increasingly more noticeable lack thereof. But the reaction to the late-night appearance that I found most revealing wasn't about presidential age. It was about what happened next. Biden and Meyers went for ice cream after the show, and Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama fired off a post on social media, hoping Biden enjoyed his ice cream, quote, "while the rest of the city is afraid of crime and migrants," unquote. Reporters and readers are quick to point out that, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2021, Alabama had a homicide rate more than three times as high as that of New York State. And, as Bloomberg's Justin Fox notes, New York City is among the safest big cities in America. Tuberville has become known for getting crossed up on the issues, but his comment illustrated two larger aspects of our politics. First, there's a striking double standard in the way politicians are allowed to talk about different regions of America. Voters from rural states often complain about not getting enough respect. But can you imagine the reaction if, say, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a New York Democrat, were to ascribe Alabama, which in 2021 had an extraordinarily high rate of firearm mortality, as a place where everyone runs around shooting one another and themselves? Second, and more important, I'm always struck by the extent to which today's right-wing politics is driven by a grim, dystopian image of America, especially American cities, that just isn't grounded in reality. A lot of this seems to reflect perceptions that congealed long ago and haven't been updated to reflect the ways in which urban America has changed for the better. New York really was a dangerous place a few decades back. There were 2,262 murders in 1990. Last year, however, with the pandemic-era bump in crime rapidly receding, there were only 391, still too many, and early indicators are that violent crime is continuing to fall. Nationally, violent crime, at least according to the FBI, is approaching a 50-year low. There are official statistics, but what about personal experience? I remember New York in the bad old days, and it's nothing like that now. Polling on crime is remarkable, especially when broken down by partisan affiliation. According to Gallup, 78% of Republicans say that crime is an extremely or very serious problem for the nation, but only 16% say it's a serious problem where they live. That's not because Republicans live in safer places. Only 15% of Democrats say that local crime is a serious problem. Crime isn't the only subject where Republicans seem to be living in the past. In another recent speech, Trump declared, quote, "We're like a third world nation. Look at our airports. I mean, how bad are the airports?" unquote. He may have been thinking of LaGuardia in the 1970s. I recently landed at Newark's New Terminal A, and it was a striking reminder of just how gentrified America's major airports have become. Trump has also been going on lately about migrant crime being through the roof, singling out New York, naturally. But as I've already noted, homicides in New York, where 36% of the population is foreign-born, have been falling rapidly. And while there have, of course, been violent crimes committed by immigrants, including those here illegally, an analysis by NBC News found that, quote, despite several horrifying high-profile episodes, there is no evidence of a migrant-driven crime wave in the United States, unquote. None of this says that we should have an open border. Indeed, this year, Democrats and Republicans in the Senate agreed on a bill that would have greatly stiffened border security. Republicans then backed out at Trump's behest, pretty clearly because Trump wants to keep the fear factor going. Now, I'm not saying that everything is fine. Americans were badly rattled by a crime surge in 2020-21 and an inflation surge in 21-22, both of which were probably, for the most part, aftershocks from the COVID-19 pandemic. Both surges now appear to be rapidly receding, but the unease remains, and there are still plenty of social and economic problems to address. Yet in 2024, Trump and his party appear to be running not against America's rising problems, but against problems that have actually become much less dire. Can a political party really win a national election on the strength of dystopian fantasies? Unfortunately, current polling suggests that it can. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, March 6th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember that you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.